Today is Thursday, February 25th, 2021. This is part 14 of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Carl Bowman, spelled B-O-W-M-A-N. My name is Tom Martin. Good morning, Carl. How are you today?
Good morning, Tom. I'm doing really well.
Good. May we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone?
Yes, you may.
Thank you very much. You had taken us through the Grand Canyon Visibility Transportation, the Grand Canyon Visibility Transport Commission, and brought us up to the Western Regional Air Partnership, started in the early 1996, late 1995. Can you pick that thread up?
Sure. So, of course, the whole purpose of the Grand Canyon Visibility Transport Commission was to come up with recommendations to EPA on how to improve visibility, the clarity of the air over all these Colorado Plateau parks and wilderness areas and stuff. And so, and so its job was pretty much done once we handed off those recommendations. But the recommendations didn't do anything to improve air quality. It was just, it was just ideas on a piece of paper. And so so EPA took those, and then it was up to EPA, the states, and the tribes to actually start implementing those recommendations. And so the various states of the tribes and stuff of the Western, of the Grand Canyon Visibility Transport Commission reformed as the Western Regional Air Partnership. And I think I mentioned earlier that we did get some additional coverage with the Western Regional Air Partnership. Montana became part of it. Idaho and Washington, I think Washington became part. Idaho, I think, was looking at it, but was kind of in an observer status. And eventually, the province of Alberta up in Canada actually showed some interest, although that was kind of after my time. So Western Regional Air Partnership was forming up, and it was looking at implementing these recommendations from the Visibility Transport Commission and integrating them into other policies that were going on. And so I kind of maintained the same role that I'd had in the Visibility Transport Commission, where I was the federal co-chair of the Communications Committee. But as the Western Regional Air Partnership kind of got off the ground, it was no longer a mandated program by EPA or anything like that. It was just an agreement among these states and tribes to move forward on implementing the recommendations. Meanwhile, EPA went off on their track of actually writing a rule, basically setting the standards for regional haze on a nationwide basis.
Okay.
So we, we got the Western Regional Air Partnership going, coming up with a name, coming up with logos, coming up with work plans and all that kind of stuff, integrating new studies and that sort of thing that have come in and refined information and all that. Meanwhile, EPA worked on their regional haze rule. EPA came out with a regional haze rule, and lo and behold, very few of the recommendations of the Grand Canyon Visibility Transport Commission showed up in it.
Oh, wow.
Which caused something of an uproar among everybody who had worked all these years on coming up with the recommendations. And so that uproar sent EPA back to the drawing board. And
why do you think they dropped those recommendations?
I think what happened, and this is just retrospect of something that I wasn't really involved in.
Right, sure.
Other than being part of the uproar. I think what happened was that the folks back in the Washington office the headquarters at EPA,
mm-hmm.
were trying to come up with a one-size-fits-all, whereas the Transport Commission recommendations were specifically designed to deal with the Colorado Plateau and, to a lesser extent, to the western United States.
That makes sense.
And so the upshot of it all was that the EPA said, oh, okay, my mistake. And they went back and revised their draft rule to acknowledge the work that had gone in to the Transport Commission, and a lot of our stuff showed up in there, in the revised rule, the rule that finally came out.
Okay.
And so as a consequence, once that rule was officially in place, then it was up to the states and the tribes to then start developing their state or tribal implementation plans to achieve the standards that EPA had set in the goals. And I make it sound very sequential, but of course, everybody knew that this was the process. So it wasn't as if, like the state of Arizona was, oh my gosh, now we have to do a state implementation plan for protecting visibility. They'd known all along that that was going to be coming, and so had been working on it
okay.
through the Transport Commission and other things. So all these things were moving forward at the same time. Meanwhile, the Western Regional Air Partnership was kind of consolidating and deciding, okay, how are we going to move forward? And the Western Governors Association already had an air quality program that was addressing a variety of things beyond just visibility. They were, you know, looking at what we call criteria pollutants, things like ozone and nitrogen oxides and other air pollutants that EPA had established numeric concentrations that had to be achieved to protect public health and that sort of thing. So it was So the Western Regional Air Partnership was relying in large part on the Western Governors Association to help. What do I want to say? Eventually, they kind of merged. The Western Regional Air Partnership remained an entity, but most of its work was carried out under the auspices of the Western Governors Association.
That's interesting. When I think of the Western Governors Association, I think of a group that I must be totally wrong, is not very far-thinking, stuck to the old ways is kind of what I think.
Yeah. In some ways they were, and in some ways they weren't.
Okay.
You know, it was, what do I say? On the one hand, the Western states, some of them have real air pollution problems. You know, you look at, like, the brown cloud over Phoenix or the Los Angeles Basin.
Or Salt Lake City, I mean, yeah.
In the Western Governors Association, there was a genuine interest in improving air quality.
Okay.
They also knew that tourism was a big part of the economy and that visibility figured into that tourism, and that improving things like visibility in remote areas, they could leverage against improving air quality in general in urban areas.
Okay.
I think I mentioned it before that they could say, okay, you know, if we implement these rules here in Los Angeles, not only does it help us in Los Angeles, but it also helps clear the air over Grand Canyon. So
right.
it gave them another arrow in their quiver.
Mm.
And in fact, one of the things that at some later meetings, the head of the air quality group at the Arizona Department of Environmental Quality, she used to say, you know, yeah, in the we all worry about the brown cloud over Phoenix in the wintertime, but in the summertime, it takes a vacation and goes to the Grand Canyon, just like we do.
Right.
And so there was, there was that going on. The flip side of it was that, states had their own concerns. I remember working in Arizona on the state implementation plan for visibility, and one of the part of the marching orders was that nothing would in the plan would interfere with the real estate development or development of the Phoenix Basin.
Wow.
So yeah, that's like, okay, so how are we going to pull that off? So these things were evolving and actually continue to evolve even to today. Some of the recommendations of the Visibility Transport Commission have pretty long horizons, and programs today that are being implemented at the state by the states and EPA, you can still find their roots back in the old Visibility Transport Commission recommendations. One of the examples is getting low sulfur diesel fuel for highway vehicles and that sort of thing.
Okay.
Originally started, people have been thinking about it, but actually came out as a recommendation of the Transport Commission that then the Western Regional Air Partnership worked on implementing. And is now the way things work all over the country.
Hmm.
So even though it was a huge project and all that kind of stuff, the Grand Canyon Visibility Transport Commission simply made recommendations, and actually implementing those recommendations was the hard part of the work. And it's
right.
Still going on today, but it's been incorporated into other programs. And so as that was happening, the structure of the Western Regional Air Partnership pretty much started out as a continuation of the Grand Canyon Visibility Transport Commission. It had, it had worked to get the recommendations out, and it still worked to get the Western Regional Air Partnership off the ground. But as the partnership evolved, various things were no longer necessary, and one of those was the Communications Committee. And so for a few years, the Communications Committee continued as an organ of the Western Regional Air Partnership. But once we got things set up, websites set up and communications roles and procedures and stuff established, there was less and less use for the having a communications committee.
Okay.
And so eventually that was dissolved, and that in a way sort of ended my direct involvement with the Western Regional Air Partnership. We've been doing less and less and less, and finally after about 4 or 5 years, they said, we really don't need a communications committee anymore. We've got the Communications Committee of the individual states and tribes and the Western Governors Association. So we'll put you guys on standby. And that was the end of it.
So did that mean that Grand Canyon National Park no longer had representation in the Western Regional Air Partnership program?
Not directly. The National Park Service still did.
Okay.
The federal land managers still had their responsibility, and that's kind of how my job morphed in respect to air quality issues at Grand Canyon. Was that as my involvement with the Western Regional Air Partnership declined, my involvement with especially the state of Arizona increased. Instead of going to RAP meetings up in Denver, I started going to DEQ meetings down in Phoenix.
Okay.
And it was actually a fairly, at least from my point of view, a fairly smooth transition.
Okay.
And I would, I've been going to DEQ as part of the Transport Commission. So I was a known quantity down there. And I'd kind of cut my teeth on the politics, I guess you could say, of air quality management when the Grand Canyon Visibility Transport Commission was at first starting up. The first couple of meetings I went to, it was kind of like, I don't even know what I'm doing here. There was a lot of technical stuff going on that I didn't understand. There was obviously a lot of politics going on behind the scenes mm-hmm. that I knew nothing about. And at that time, I went to the folks in the Washington office, especially Chris Shaver, and said, you know, I'm kind of out of my depth here. I don't know what I'm going to contribute to this whole thing. And they said, oh, just stay involved. You'll pick it up. And as it
was nice of them to say that.
Yeah. As it turned out, I did pick it up.
Uh-huh.
And eventually I became the, you know, I was still the air quality specialist for Grand Canyon. But in Arizona, I was the only air quality specialist in the National Park Service. Other parks, Petrified Forest, Chiricahua, Saguaro, had air quality programs, but it was kind of a collateral duty for somebody on that staff to deal with. And I was the only person with a full-time job. And so I wound up taking on more and more statewide responsibilities. It was kind of an interesting dynamic. The resource management specialist at Saguaro, Meg Wiesner, was also very involved in air quality issues relating to Saguaro because of the Tucson, you know, they're right there in Tucson.
Right. That park is both sides of the valley of Tucson city boundaries. That park mm-hmm. straddles both sides of that place. So
yeah. And so Meg was pretty good on the urban stuff, and I was pretty good on the rural stuff, and then I was also working with the Forest Service because of prescribed fire, the Forest Service had gotten pretty involved in the Transport Commission,
mm-hmm.
and the management of air quality impacts from prescribed managed fires was becoming more and more of an issue. And so I'd been working with the Forest Service, and I'm not sure how it's set up now, but at that time, the Park Service, the Forest Service, and all the federal land managers shipped in to fund a position that was nominally housed in the Forest Service in the Tonto National Forest, but actually was a person who worked at Arizona Department of Environmental Quality to help manage wildland fire air quality impacts. Named Pete Lom, and he eventually went on to work in the Washington office in much the same role. But we were, Pete was very good in terms of working with the forests and working with the DEQ, balancing the need for fire and the need for air quality.
Right. Hey, Carl, you mentioned Meg Wiesner. How do you spell Meg's last name?
If I remember right, it's Weesner.
Thank you. And then Pete's last name?
Lahm, Lahm.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And again, when I think of ADEQ, Arizona Department of Environmental Quality, I think of our governors, and again, like I think of the Western Governors Association, I'm not necessarily very progressive at times, and might not be too sensitive to this issue of air quality. But as you pointed out, the Western Governors Association tied air quality to tourism. Was the AZDEQ doing the same thing?
They were doing that, and they were also very big on tying it to the improvements we make here. Help, here being Phoenix and Tucson, help faraway areas as well.
Okay.
And the other thing about DEQ is that the people who actually work in the department, I think, were concerned. Well, I know they were concerned about air quality. Now, of course, their primary concern was health impacts in the metropolitan areas.
Okay.
But at the same time, they realized the connections between those and visibility in the Class 1 areas, the parks and wilderness areas. And I think that you could say that that's where their real interest was.
Mm-hmm.
And so, especially as you moved up the ranks, those people had to be politically savvy.
Right.
And like they say, politics is the art of the possible.
Mm.
So, much as they would have liked to maybe have implemented certain programs, they knew it wasn't going to happen. So they were always, I think, always working to see how they could get the most bang for the buck out of making improvements in air quality.
Okay.
And at the same time, you know, there was a lot of education that had to go on for the federal land managers as well. I remember discussions where they were talking about, the Forest Service wants to do all of their prescribed burns in this 2-week period in October because that's when they can count on the snow coming to put out anything that gets away, and the weather's usually pretty good to disperse the smoke, and so so everybody wanted to do all their prescribed fire, at the same time, and that just wasn't going to work. We were going to have to spread it out over the course of the year, and I remember at Grand Canyon, the fire folks had this idea that the Organic Act of the Park Service trumps the Clean Air Act, and that's not true. In fact, the Clean Air Act trumps the Park Service Organic Act.
Hmm.
By the way, laws work. It's a case of in theory and in the way the laws work is that when Congress passes a law, they pass it in cognizant of every other law that's ever been passed before.
Hmm.
And so when they passed the Clean Air Act, it superseded the Organic Act because the Park Service Organic Act was passed earlier. And so Congress would have considered that Organic Act while they were crafting the Clean Air Act. Well, in reality, I don't know if they ever paid it any mind at all, but that's the way our legal system works.
Okay.
And it took me a while to convince people of that kind of like, no, actually, it's the other way around, and people are willing to work together, but you can't just have it all your way.
Right.
And so what would happen was I would go to meetings in Phoenix to work on the state implementation plan for visibility. And initially, the Washington office would send somebody down as well. And in the first few meetings, they were doing the heavy lifting. And then their participation, partly due to budget constraints and that sort of stuff, but it kind of declined to they would be in on a conference call, and then eventually it would be me. And it actually, as my role grew, it wasn't that the Washington office, the Resources Division, role declined, but it was easier for me to get to Phoenix for a one-day meeting.
Right.
And politically, it was a lot more palatable to the other people around the table to be talking to Carl from the Grand Canyon than it would be to be talking to somebody that was from the Beltway, from inside the Beltway. And, of course, I would spend days before these meetings talking to people inside the Beltway to find out what I was supposed to say. And everybody around the table knew that. But at the same time, it, you know, it was the way those things sort of work. And so I at the same time, you know, I would try and keep the lines of communication open with the other parks, the other class one area parks around Arizona with, you know, varying degrees of success. Some parks, you know, like Saguaro, Meg lots of times showed up at those meetings and would be there as well. And I remember I would talk to the folks down at Chiricahua, and they would be just, oh, this is great. Well, explain to us about this, that, and the other. And then I could find out what was happening there and try to address some of their needs and so forth and so on. So I was becoming more and more involved in state dealings as my involvement in the Western regional efforts kind of declined.
It's interesting when I think of Chiricahua, they've got a fairly large power plant northwest of them, south of I-10. They've got the Cananea smelters in Mexico at the big copper mines down there, and they've got power plants to the east of them. Besides the major city center of Tucson to the northwest of them. So they've got, you know, it's just interesting just thinking about the different service units and the big pollutant generators not too far away.
Yeah, and it was, you know, it was kind of a matter of degree, because a lot of the stuff that Chiricahua experienced in their local environment was the same sort of stuff that impacted us up on the Colorado Plateau, especially in the summertime when airflow, you know, the monsoon was coming up from the south. In the wintertime, you're dealing with much more localized impacts.
Right.
In the summertime, like some of our problems would start to overlap in a big way.
Interesting.
So that was going on. I was dealing more and more with the state. By that point, I most of the time had an assistant to help me run the monitoring network, and it was started out fairly early on as a volunteer status. And then it was part-time seasonal and that kind of stuff. But eventually I got up to the point where I actually had someone working for me most of the time to actually run out and take care of the monitoring sites. And it was a case of they could do pretty much everything, but if something weird happened, I would still have to step in and do it. And
you could cover for their vacations or whatever time off they needed as
right,
well.
Right.
So that worked.
And it was a case of and I could the various contractors that we had, or cooperators or whatever, depending on the monitoring network in question, I'd been there long enough that I had a certain rapport with them, and so they'd say, okay, well, yeah, you can do this, but we want you to do it. We don't want somebody else to do it. And so I would go out to the site and disembowel a machine and make replacements to it and that sort of thing.
mostly work you had done before and you were familiar with the machine and how to do it. And
right.
Sure.
And there were some procedures where I knew how to do it, and I would just do it, even though there was one instrument called the transmissometer, where the transmissometer is the one that shoots a light beam over a distance of a few miles. We had one that went from Phantom Ranch up to Yavapai Point, and one that went from Moran Point on the south rim over to Grandview Point. And they were, you would, the light output at the source was known. You would measure the light received at the other end, and that would tell you how hazy the air was.
Mm-hmm.
But it was more complicated than that, because when you were measuring the light beam, you needed to ignore all the other light that was coming in. You know, is somebody standing next to the transmitter with a flashlight?
Hmm.
You know, is it daytime or nighttime?
Right.
And that sort of thing.
Hmm.
And so the light source actually had a little spinning disc in front of the lamp. And the spinning disc would, we called it a chopper because it would chop the light beam.
Right.
The light would shine through a slot in the disc, and then it would go off and then shine through. So the light was actually flickering 60 times a second.
Wow, that's fast.
Yeah. And so then the receiver would actually search for that
signal
60 times a second cycle,
okay,
lock into that, and make its measurements based on that. Well, sometimes that little disc would fall off its spindle.
Oops.
And to get to it, you had to get down inside the guts of the transmitter, where there was a whole bunch of exposed wiring and expensive integrated circuits,
right,
and all that kind of stuff.
Huh.
And so I knew how to fix the chopper, and so I would, I go through the process of elimination. We got, okay, it's the chopper, it's fallen off. There were a number of ways to tell. And then I knew how to take the machine apart, fix it, put it back together again. Some of the folks up in the contracting office were comfortable with me doing that. Other ones weren't.
Hmm.
The alternative was to dismantle the entire transmitter, ship it to Colorado, have them fix it, have it come back, and all that kind of stuff. And so I just started doing it.
Okay.
And it was kind of, instead of asking permission, I just sort of begged forgiveness.
Right.
And that worked pretty well. Sometimes it didn't. We had a data logger on the ozone monitoring that wasn't working quite right. And so I was trying to trace the circuit to figure out which wire was broken or not connected or whatever. And the probe on my voltmeter, I accidentally shorted out the power supply.
Oops. Oh, that was sparked.
there was this ball of flame about, it wasn't as big as a basketball, but you know, it was pretty big. About half of the metal probe vaporized.
Right.
And the data logger didn't work anymore.
Oh, well, not surprised.
Yeah. And that was one that it turned out that they didn't have a spare. I was going to have to fix it. And it took me about a week and a half to get everything back together and functioning properly. So
not bad.
So I wasn't entirely fail-safe in my manipulation. But you know, that's that sort of stuff, and then covering for days off, or vacations, and then we were still getting involved in special studies.
Okay.
In the park as well.
Like what?
So, it was Grand Canyon. had a reputation as being a good place to monitor air quality because we had the staff and the park commitment to follow through on stuff. And so there was Grand Canyon, Great Smokies, Shenandoah, Yosemite were kind of, what would I say, flagship parks. All of us had air quality people who were involved in the politics, who were involved in the monitoring and that sort of stuff. All of us had different strengths and weaknesses, but it made us good test beds for experimenting with different procedures or just special studies in general. One of the ones that we did, actually, it was Grand Canyon and Shenandoah, was the Park Service had its ozone monitoring network, measuring the concentration of ozone in the air. EPA also had an ozone monitoring network. And in the late 90s, as funding became less and less available, both the Park Service and the EPA were kind of racing each other. Okay, let's go with your system. No, let's go with your system. No, why don't you take it over? No, we want you to take it over. And so Grand Canyon and Shenandoah were the two parks that already had both systems in operation as kind of a check. And so we did an intensive study, I think, gosh, I don't remember how long it lasted. It was about a month, I believe, where we started swapping things back and forth. We'll use the gas supply line from the EPA network into the Park Service instruments and vice versa, and we'll do this and we'll do that, and just kind of trading things back and forth to see what differences there were in the results from the two monitoring networks and where those differences were coming from. And so, I was doing that. Another one was particulate monitoring, where we were curious. Particulate monitoring, we only did 2 days a week. And it's kind of, okay, what are we missing on those other 5 days that we're not monitoring?
Right.
And what are we missing by doing a 24-hour sample versus shorter time periods and that sort of thing? And so we would do special studies where we would do sampling every day, or we would do sampling for four-hour periods instead of 24-hour periods.
Or morning, afternoon. I mean, a lot of regional weather is going to get involved here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you would get, swirls and eddies where you would have a pocket of air blowing by that might be very different from what's blowing by most of the time. And that's something that, we saw even in the results of the Project Mojave study that we talked about in the last interview, where averaged out over the day on the South Rim, there was not very much impact from the emissions from the Mojave power plant. But if you looked at shorter and shorter time periods, you would find periods of a few hours where there was very much an impact from the plant. But it was just in some little swirl or eddy of air that blew by and then was gone, and it just sort of disappeared if you were doing averaging over a 24-hour period or longer. So we were doing special studies like that to get a better handle on different aspects. I did a study with that was actually run by the state, where they were looking at radioactive particles in the air. And unfortunately, they did it like a year or two after the blow up at Chernobyl. The state normally does that in a number of places, but there was the big boom in uranium prospecting and everything on the Colorado Plateau. and they were saying, you know, we should get some background data just in case any of these mines start to open up.
Yeah.
And so they wanted to open up, or they wanted to do a study, and it's kind of like, okay, well, we'll go to Grand Canyon. They have a program, and they came to me. They wanted to set up a monitoring site on the south rim and one on the north rim and run it for, I think it was 4 years. And I said, well, that's going to be fine, but your samples on the north rim are going to be pretty problematic since it's closed for half the year.
Right.
And so we settled instead on doing the study with two sampling sites. One of them was at Hopi Fire Tower, right across the street from the Orphan Mine.
Right.
And then the other one was out at our one of our main monitoring sites. We called it the Abyss, and it was out near Hermit's Rest. And
those two locations are not that far apart. I would have assumed that they would have wanted something like out of Toro Weep, or, you know, that had year-round access for the most part, but was further away.
Well, yeah, but at Toro Weep, who's going to run it? And we've got problems with electricity,
right?
Problems with getting the samples back into the lab to be analyzed quickly and that sort of thing. So we did do that radiation study. Actually, oddly enough, it turned out that the Abyss site had a higher concentration of radionuclides than the Hopi Fire Tower site.
Really? That's curious, given the location of the fire tower adjacent to a uranium mine right across the street.
We finally decided that the Abyss site is in an old quarry. Very shallow, only a few feet deep, but that was used for construction of the Western Drive, you know, decades and decades ago.
Yeah.
But perhaps that disturbed soil was emitting enough radionuclides that...
Fascinating. It was,
talking about Toro Weep, we did do a study at one point. We were looking at ozone transport out of Las Vegas.
Hmm.
And it was a pilot study that never evolved into a full-scale study. But we had the ozone monitors at Grand Canyon Village. But the correlation at Grand Canyon Village with ozone levels in Las Vegas wasn't very good. And it's kind of like, okay, where's all this ozone going? And so we did actually set up a gradient where we set up a monitoring station at Meadview, one at Toro Weep, and then utilized the one on the South Rim.
Hmm.
And then those were doing continuous ozone sampling, and then some passive ozone samplers that we put down inside of the canyon and some other different locations, as well as next to the continuous monitors. The site at Toro Weep, we put out at the old dump on the west side of Toro Weep Valley.
Mm-hmm.
So the roads, it's the road that goes to a place called the Cove.
Yes.
And it was on the west side of the valley, just as it starts to climb out of the valley bottom.
Okay.
Right at the edge of some of the lava flows there. And it was an interesting site. There, it was the old dump. There was a soundboard from the piano out there, something like that. But the monitoring station itself actually looked like some kind of a lunar lander or something. It was a tripod, a large tripod that held up a tall mast. It was entirely solar powered, and it had a satellite phone link back when satellite phones were still kind of
fairly new. Yeah.
New stuff, but it was doing its monitoring. We ran that one for a couple of years, and the first year, I can't remember who the ranger was, but there was a ranger at Tuweep. The second year there wasn't, so that became an issue because periodically the instrument would break down,
right?
And so I'd have to do these day trips out to Tuweep.
Oh wow!
To fix it. And could tell from the data, they could give me an idea before I went out what I would need and ship me. They'd left me with some spare parts, and if there was something weird, they'd ship it to me.
Hmm.
And then I'd leave at, like, 5 o'clock in the morning,
right,
or something like that, drive out to Tui, work on the instrument, and then drive back and get back, like, 9 or 10 o'clock that night.
Right.
I remember one time, it was during the monsoon, I drove out, and I got, maybe half a mile or a mile from the ranger station, and the floor of the valley was flooded.
Oh, wow.
And it's kind of like, okay, I'm not going to drive across, who knows whether the road is muddy enough that I'm going to be able to make it
right
over to the other side. So I had to walk in about the last mile with this pack full of the equipment, wading through ankle-deep water to get over to the monitoring site, fix everything up, come back. And the whole time I'm working, of course, that day's thunderheads are building up. I got out, and I'd always have to fill up with gas at the station there by Pipe Spring.
Yeah.
As I'm filling up with gas, I see this huge thunderstorm just dumping cloudburst and everything on the two-week road.
Mm.
About 20 miles off to the south. And it's like, well, I guess I got out just in time.
Yeah.
So, huh. So we were, we were doing a lot of these kind of special studies at the same time. And then the other thing that I just kind of kept getting more and more involved with was smoke management, because it was, coming from the Visibility Transport Commission, but also just that the fire program at Grand Canyon was getting bigger and bigger. And periodically, we were getting some pretty humongous smoke impacts,
mm-hmm,
in the canyon from fires that we had started. And
in Tucson, kind of, the gateway community as well.
Yeah, and it was kind of, okay, how are we gonna deal with this?
Hmm.
I talk to people, I say, yeah, it was a case of, yeah, I knew we needed to burn the ponderosa pine, especially. We needed to burn those woodlands.
Right.
But my job wasn't to preserve the woodlands. My job was to preserve the air. And so I'd have to go over and whine and throw fits over at fire about the smoke that they were dumping into the canyon. But it was, they were, for the most part, they were receptive to that.
Uh-huh.
It's like, okay, what do we need to do?
Right.
And so gradually we started coming up with better and better prescriptions and techniques and that sort of thing to manage some of those fires.
What kind of techniques would you come up with for that? Because, you've got to burn the place, so how would you do it?
Part of it was judging the weather,
okay,
having tighter controls on the weather forecast during the duration of the burn to make sure that we would have some wind. Because the big problem was not so much seeing a smoke plume. It's kind of like, okay, yeah, in theory, you don't want to see a smoke plume, but in a lot of ways you could consider the smoke plume natural,
because
mm-hmm, the forest did burn in the past. But what we didn't want to do was have a lot of smoke at night draining into the canyon or draining into Tucson, although
right,
that was less our problem, more the Kaibab forest problem, and then sitting there until the canyon ventilated the next day when the air started to warm up.
Right.
So how can we take advantage of weather systems, and also how can we time the ignitions to minimize the risk of that happening? And there were a number of ways of doing it. One is to burn in front of a front a day or two before a cold front is predicted to come and blow everything away. Another is to light things off very early in the morning. So, you're going to generate smoke night when the smoke is going to drain into the canyon. But within a few hours, likely before that smoke even reaches Tucson or really starts pouring into the canyon, the air is going to warm up enough that that smoke is going to lift as a plume and blow away. Sometimes it didn't work. And I remember there was one fire that had gone on. It was filling up the canyon with smoke. This was fairly early on, filling up the canyon with smoke with night after night after night. And the daytime ventilation just wasn't enough to clear things out. And so, you know, eventually I said, I threw a big fit and said, well, you know, what can we do? And we actually wound up burning out the rest of the fire. Where we went to the natural control lines, in this case, the fire was on the north rim. It was burning slowly towards the rim. And so they went over and burned up the rest of the area between the fire and the rim. We had horrendous impacts for one day. Mm-hmm. And then the next day, everything was clearing out. And that actually, these burnout operations actually worked fairly well. We had one that was kind of disappointing. We'd gotten to the point where we decided, no, we need to burn this guy out, finish this fire off. The impacts have gone on long enough. We burned it out. And so the next morning, the air's drifting up, or the smoke is drifting out of the canyon. The canyon is clearing up. There's not a lot of new smoke because we burned most of the fuel up the day before. And then that afternoon, this huge, incredible smoke plume from Southern California blew in, and it was the worst visibility I've ever recorded at Grand Canyon.
Right.
So we got our smoke out just in time to make room for California's smoke.
And people were wondering, where should we go backpacking that, you know, we can actually get a view of the canyon, because the air quality was horrible.
Right. I was actually, the day that happened, I actually, for whatever reason, had to go down to Indian Garden to change filters in the particulate monitor down there. And so, you know, I started out in the morning up on the rim and saw the smoke from the fire. It was over, I believe that one was over near Point Sublime. Saw it blowing away from the canyon and things clearing up. And it's like, oh, great, you know, it's working. Mm. And then while I'm down in the canyon, things keep getting darker and darker. And I'm kind of like, this looks like smoke. Maybe things didn't work out quite so well. But it didn't smell like smoke. It had the color of smoke, but not the smell of smoke.
Right.
And as I was hiking out of the canyon, it was so thick, I could look straight at the sun and see huge sunspots.
Wow.
And a couple of nights after that was one of the times we saw the northern lights there on the south rim.
Huh.
At that time, we installed the web camera up on Yavapai Museum. And so I downloaded the pictures, and then it was really obvious. You could go through the pictures over the course of the day and see the smoke from the north rim clearing out, and then this dark wedge appearing in the southwest.
Interesting.
And gradually engulfing the whole canyon as that California smoke blew in.
Wow.
Huh. So I put together a little PowerPoint presentation on that one, talking about, you know, when things go right and when things go wrong.
Right, right. Huh.
So as the years went on, we got better and better, not only at timing our fires and managing our fires, but also, you know, working with the state and trying out different things. There were a few things that the technology just wasn't there yet. There were a number of computer models to predict smoke behavior from wildland fires. And one example of that was I would run the computer model, and I could not get smoke to drain into Tucson.
Hmm.
It was so funny. No matter how I tweaked the model, smoke would always blow over the top. And, of course, it's obvious that that's not what happened.
It doesn't work that way. Yeah. Hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. They'd get those inversions that would settle in there. And
yeah.
I remember one fire where they were talking about the smoke was so thick in Tucson, it was setting off smoke detectors in people's houses.
Oh, wow.
And yet you could climb up during the night, you could climb up on top of the engines, the fire engines in Tucson, and it would get your head above the smoke layer.
Wow.
You could look up and see the stars.
Huh.
You know, it just the atmosphere was just so incredibly stable.
Wow.
That that smoke was a layer about 10 or 15 feet thick, just sitting in the valley bottom there in Tucson.
And so, working at the clinic, there were some community members that had severe respiratory problems, and so when these fires were going to go off, they would basically leave the park and go to Flagstaff or points further away and check into a hotel.
Mm-hmm.
To get away from the air.
At one point, the park was actually I can't remember how it worked, because it was not something I was involved with. I just knew about the park would actually pay, expenses for those folks to go to Williams or Flagstaff or whatever.
Okay.
Until the lawyers found out that we were doing it, and they said, no, we couldn't, because by doing that, we were admitting liability for anything that happened.
Oh, interesting.
And they made us quit. But yeah, and it eventually got to the point where, we had portable particulate monitors. They weren't very good. They weren't particularly accurate, but it's I would tell people, they were called data rams. And I tell them, data rams, they're not very accurate, but they're very portable. And if you put two of them side by side, they usually don't agree with each other, but
wow,
they're very portable. they break down a lot, but they're very portable. And they were the technology that we had available, and so Fire bought some of them, and then we would just deploy them where we could, we came up with a whole monitoring plan for wildland fires, and we would deploy data rams at not where we thought we would get the highest concentrations of smoke, but where what we called critical receptors. And critical receptors were any place that people were directed to spend the night. So that could be Phantom Ranch, that could be the town of Tucson, that could be down by the Maswick Lodge, where a critical receptor where we expected the heaviest impacts. And so before a fire, I would go out, set up the data rams, and then fire, depending on the location, either I would download the data rams or fire would download the data rams, or the two of us together would cooperate on, okay, who's going to do this one? And then I would do daily reports, and they took quite a while, where I would compile the data and prepare a report on the smoke behavior, the health potential health impacts, and predictions on what was going to happen over the next couple of days, and send them over to fire.
Okay.
And then that way, that gave them a heads up as to, okay, things were bad, but they're going to get better tomorrow, or things are bad and we don't see a way out of this for the next 5 days.
Hmm.
Or whatever,
right?
And they could make the appropriate management decisions as to whether to burn out a fire or tell people to suck it up or whatever. And those work pretty well.
It's interesting because I think, all right, well, the best time to do it is before a front. Well, if the fire doesn't go out, you're going to have a bunch of high winds and a fire, and that's a perfect time to have a fire run away from you.
Like the outlet fire.
Yes. So,
yeah.
Boy, how do you balance that?
Yeah, and that's where the helicopter was usually so good to have, because with the helicopter and I forget what they call it, but basically the helicopter flew at very low altitudes over a burn area, and they had a machine called the ping pong machine, but it would take these little balls that looked like ping pong balls, and they were full of a chemical. I believe it was ethylene glycol, but anyway, they're full of a chemical, and the machine would shoot the ping pong balls out where you wanted the fire to be, and as it was shooting them, it would inject a second chemical into the ping pong ball that would start a chemical reaction, so that the ping pong ball would be this little pellet of flame when it hit the ground.
Right.
And they were pretty good with those things. So in a fire, what you want to light first are the heavy fuels, the logs and stuff that you want to burn up, because they're going to take the longest to burn.
Hmm.
You know, it doesn't take long to burn up a bunch of pine needles, but a bunch of dead logs do. And so they could fly over the fire, they could light off the heavy fuels, and they could light off hundreds and hundreds of places, so that instead of one big fire front roaring through the woods, you've got a bunch of smaller fires that spread, but then run into another small fire that's already consumed the fuel.
Okay.
So that you can burn a lot of acres over a very short period of time, create a smoke plume that lifts up and disperses, and get your major burning done all, you know, over the course of a day in some cases. And that usually worked pretty well. And then that way, you know, any residual smoke from those heavy fuels still burning, if there was a front coming, it could disperse that smoke, but there wasn't enough fuel left for the fire to spread.
Right.
And like I say, usually that worked. There was the Long Jim fire over east of the visitor center, the Canyon View area, where in that case it was the weather forecast that was off. And so they sent up the helicopter. The helicopter had already ignited the fire. They were about halfway through when the weather service called and said, oh, by the way, the winds are going to be twice as strong today as what we'd originally predicted, and we thought you ought to know.
Hmm.
But by that time, we'd already started the fire. And so the solution was to finish lighting the fire and get as much as they could done before those heavy winds started. But that was the fire that jumped the East Rim Drive and burned on out to the rim, and we had the slurry bombers over the visitor center and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and over the village, over the clinic. I mean, it was great. We walked outside and got some great views of the bottom of a plane flying over us.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Wondering, what is going on with the fire department here? fire folks.
Yeah, that was trying to make lemonade out of lemons. Mm. And I guess, you know, it was a case of nobody got killed and we didn't lose any buildings.
Right.
And so it was the world's best lemonade, but...
I remember calling dispatch saying, should we, like, you know, be ready to evacuate the clinic? And they were like, no, I don't think so. We'll call you if you do. I'm like, okay, great, thanks.
That I was, ironically, that particular day I was over on the North Rim teaching a smoke management class.
Oh, my gosh.
So I had gone out that morning before class and, you know, just took a look at the canyon there from there was an air quality wayside exhibit just east of the lodge.
Hmm.
And I'd gone out there and took a picture of it, and then I went out there at lunch, and it was, oh my God, couldn't see a thing. Just this huge smoke plume boiling off the south rim.
Hmm.
And took some pictures, ran back and said, what the hell's going on? And I actually didn't know I was supposed to drive back to the South Rim that night. And East Rim Drive was closed, and I couldn't find out whether they'd reopened it or not, whether I was going to have to go to Flagstaff and come back up again.
Right.
And so I got to Cameron and flipped a coin and decided, oh, I'll try. And I was able to drive back in East Rim. But,
cool.
So we came up with, I think, a pretty good program. And it was very labor-intensive, and it totally relied on us having an air quality staff.
Hmm. Okay.
But when the fire management plan was being revised, when was that? It was in the early 2000s. We attempted to codify a lot of that stuff into the fire management plan as to how to address smoke impacts and especially visibility impacts. We usually didn't have health impacts. Every now and then we did. They were usually pretty brief, but on a couple of occasions, had we been using a better instrument, they would have violated health standards.
Oh.
Sort of. I don't want to say we violated the standards, because technically we didn't, but the concentrations were high enough to be unhealthy. And so we would post warnings and let people know what the prognosis was.
Right.
And so we attempted to codify a lot of that into the fire management plan. But then right about the time that was finished, I was leaving my job in air quality, and I'm not sure how much of it ever really was fully implemented.
Hmm. And what year? What was that? It would have been 2025.
Oh gosh, I quit doing air quality in 2008, I think it was.
Okay.
We've been
going here a little over an hour. Maybe this is a good time to put a comma in here. And we'll come back to 2008, and you're quitting air quality.
Okay. Yeah, a couple other things that I should probably bring in there to kind of tidy up the air quality stuff, and then we can move on to my final years.
Okay. That sounds good. I'll put down a note here. We'll tidy up air quality. Good. Okay. All right. Well, with that, why don't we conclude part 14, Grand Canyon Oral History with Carl Bowman. Today is Thursday, February 25th, 2021. My name is Tom Martin, and Carl, thank you so very much.
Sure, my pleasure.